Welcome to class, everybody. This is Bio 231. And we're going to finish up the integumentary system, move into bones today. And we're going to take a look at the schedule in just a second. Today is Tuesday, June 23rd. And one more light. That's good. Okay. And I had to reboot everything. So it seems to be working right now, so that's fantastic. All right, so here is your schedule. 23rd today, we're going to get into bone tissue. That's chapter 6. That's the last chapter on the exam, which is scheduled for tomorrow. And I'll probably be in class maybe around 8 o'clock, something like that, maybe a little bit sooner. So if you want to get here early, start taking the test, that would be fine with me because we got to do lab afterwards. All right, so don't forget, on the exam tomorrow, it's chapters 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6. And the way you prepare for that, I'm sure you all know, is that you use the study guide to know what pages in those chapters you have to read, what end of chapter questions I like, what exam figures I could maybe put on the test. And also for practice, the online questions. And all those things can be graded for you right away, so you should be getting some feedback as to how you're doing. And for learning new information or new knowledge, repetition really is the key. So the more you go over it, and the sooner you start, that is better. All right, so tomorrow is the exam, and then on Thursday is your first practicum. Okay, so, and that's just going to be on labs 1, 2, and 3. We're going to probably finish up 3, and then we got to review tomorrow. Okay, anybody got a question on the schedule at all? I think everybody's pretty good with that schedule. All right, so what do we want to finish up? In terms of the integumentary system, which is what? Skin and accessory structures. We were talking about accessory structures like hair, and I don't have any good pictures to show you of some of these glands, but there are a number of glands in the skin. Yes, question.
We have a quiz as well, right, tomorrow?
Yeah, we do. And on the board on lab, I put what's on the quiz. Okay. So let's finish up lecture, and then we'll be concerned about lab when we get to lab, okay? Okay, so glands in the skin. Basically, we got two kinds. We got sebaceous glands and sweat glands. There's some subcategories of sweat glands, but there's only one kind of sebaceous gland. And a sebaceous gland is always going to be associated with a hair follicle, and here I see a sebaceous gland. And this is kind of a strange gland because it secretes with a process we call holocrine secretion. That actually means that parts of a cell actually break away and enter a duct which carries it to the hair bulb. So that's kind of strange. All right, so it produces sebum. It's an oily substance, so it helps prevent dehydration. And it is also a bacteriostatic agent, so it also helps protect the skin from infection. And that just helps lubricate the hair that's moving from the hair bulb up above the level of the skin. The second kind of glands are sweat glands. And we got two different kinds of sweat glands. We have eccrine and apocrine. And that's what you have on the models in lab. The small ones that I see right here, these are the eccrine. These secrete basically a salt and water solution. And that's important for controlling temperature in your body, for cooling your body off. What's not shown on the picture are the apocrine glands. But the apocrine gland, you'll notice on the models in lab, are about 3 times the size of an eccrine. So they're pretty easy to pick out. And I think in lab I said where you have those are in the axillary region and inguinal region. They don't secrete water and salt, but they secrete an organic solution. Or secretion is probably a better way of saying that. And some bacteria can use that as an energy source. And so those areas of your body are a little bit more odoriferous compared to other parts of your body. A couple other subgroups of glands that are sweat glands. Ceruminous glands are in your ear canal. We call that the external auditory meatus. And it's kind of a oily, waxy material, and it helps lubricate the eardrum or the tympanic membrane, because the tympanic membrane's got to move back and forth. And if it dries out, turns into a potato chip, then it's just going to crack, right? So it's got to stay pliable, And then mammary glands are also modified sweat glands. Okay. All right, the last thing, nails. Let me show you some pictures of nails. There's just one maybe a little confusing part about nails. Okay, so nails are just flat sheets of keratinocytes, right? So they come from the stratum basale, and then they grow straight out. And is a nail harder than skin? I've asked you that with hair, and I'm not sure I like the answer I got. I think hair is stronger than just the surface of your skin. Okay, now what about a nail compared to your skin? Is it structurally more sound? Is it harder than your skin? You don't have an opinion on that. Well, okay, it is. And because there's a certain chemical inside those cells. And you got to remember the name of that chemical that gives those keratinocytes strength. It hardens them up. Anybody remember the name of that chemical? Can be confused with collagen. And it is called, it's intracellular, and it is keratin, right? So the keratinocytes that actually grow, that form the nail, are loaded with more keratin than the cells that make up your skin. And that's why they're a little bit harder. All right, so here we see the free edge of the nail. And then here is the body of the nail. We have the cuticle, which is the epinetium, and this little thing that kind of looks like a moon, that's a lunula. It's just an area where there's not a lot of blood flow underneath it. And the root of the nail is behind the epinetium, and even more underneath the skin is the nail matrix. All right, so we've got nail matrix, we've got the root of the nail, and all this part of the nail is dead. The living part of the nail is the nail matrix that we can see right here. Here's the nail matrix. That's like the stratum basale that's producing that hard nail. And that is where the nail grows from. All right, the nail does not grow from the root. That can be confusing. So you got to know that the nail grows from the matrix, which is deep inside the finger. Okay? All right, the other thing that I see on this slide, we're going to look at bones pretty much. Here's a bone in your fingertip that's called a phalanx. And I can see some other kind of connective tissue and blood vessels. Not a lot of muscle in this part of your finger. It's mostly just tendons and bone and some adipose connective tissue. And then, of course, skin that covers the tip of the fingernail. Okay, so that's pretty much it for integumentary system. Okay, and we've talked about the functions of the integumentary system already. And the only thing that I want to say about aging is that as we get older, the blood supply to the integument decreases. All right, so here we see blood supply going up into the bulb of the hair follicle, up into these dermal papillae, and throughout the dermis. As we get older, these blood vessels don't become as prevalent, right? So you have fewer of them and they don't work quite as well. And so as we get older, the cells, the fibroblasts that make elastic tissues and collagen in the dermis, they don't make quite as much anymore. So our skin starts to sag a little bit and wrinkle because it loses elasticity. And these capillaries in the hair bulb degenerate a little bit. And so remember, there's melanocytes in the root of the hair follicle over here. And so since they don't have oxygen and nutrients, these melanocytes quit producing melanin. So what happens to hair if these cells no longer can produce melanin? It changes color, right? And so hair turns white as we get older, mostly due to degeneration of these blood vessels. And of course, even the growth of a hair follicle is dependent on these blood vessels. So as we get older, our hair gets thinner, right? We have less hair follicles as a result of degeneration of these blood vessels. Okay. All right, so that's one of the things. What else? Oh, because these blood vessels aren't quite so prevalent as we get older, then the elderly are more susceptible to heat exhaustion and overheating because they can't get as much heat to the surface of their skin when they overheat because not a lot of blood is going to the skin anymore. And also these sweat glands don't work quite as well because there's a decreased blood supply to them. Right, so that's another reason why the elderly are really susceptible to overheating when it's really warm outside. Okay, those are some of the age-related effects. It's mostly just due to blood flow. So I know a lot of people are really concerned on keeping their skin as young as possible for as long as possible, and you can apply all kinds of topical ointments on your skin, okay, to get rid of wrinkles and kind of retard aging, but none of those topical treatments ever increase the vascularity or the blood supply to skin. So all those things sort of don't work very well as a result of that. Okay, not until somebody figures out how to regenerate these blood vessels. Okay, our skin is just going to get older as we get older, but it will age very rapidly if you do what to your skin? I mentioned this previously. If you go out in sunlight, that's right, if you go out in sunlight, your skin will age prematurely. Okay. All right, so that's good for the integumentary system. I'll put that away. Unless somebody has a question. Nice. So now we're going to get into bones. Where are some of these bone things at? Bones. And then bones over here. Nice. All right, so this is an introductory chapter to bones. And on the right-hand side, you can see a nice skeleton. And so we're going to talk about the components that make up the skeleton. Well, there's bone. Everybody's kind of aware of that. But there are some other components, too, like cartilage. And then the connection between bones is also part of the skeletal system. And a bone-to-bone connection is what we call a ligament. A ligament is dense, regular connective tissue, almost exactly the same thing as a tendon. But remember, a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. So if we look at the slide over here on the right, we can see the bones of the skeleton, right? And then I can see some cartilage illustrated in different colors, like this blue color right here is a hyaline cartilage. Right, that's a kind of cartilage that's not very strong. It doesn't have fibers, but it does give a little structure to this part of the body, and it's a little bit more bendable than bone. And one really nice thing about cartilage is that it's a lot lighter than bone. So we don't have to have as strong a muscles to haul our skeleton around because of the cartilage. Right? If all the cartilage in our body was bone, then it would take a lot more energy for us to walk around and go through our daily activities. Okay, we've got a couple places where there's fibrocartilage, right? That's the strongest kind. It's got fibers in it, like in the pubic symphysis, the intervertebral discs have fibrocartilage. And what kind of fiber do you see in fibrocartilage? That could be on the practicum too. What kind of fiber is that? What's a strong fiber that you're aware of? It's going to be... Okay, so here are the three kinds of fibers. You got reticular, you got elastic, and collagen. Which is the strongest? Yeah, collagen is the strongest, right? So fibrocartilage has lots of collagen. And so maybe fibrocartilage you could think of as being a combination of hyaline cartilage, which doesn't have fibers, right? And dense irregular connective tissue, which has a lot of collagen, right? So it has characteristics of both of those connective tissues. Right, and then another kind of cartilage, the last one is elastic, like what we see here in the ear, and that has elastic fibers and not so much collagen. So it's bendable, it's light, and when you bend it and let go, it goes back to its original position. All right, so what are the functions of all these things? One really important one is support. Like right now, I'm standing on my feet and the rest of the body, right, isn't falling on the floor because my skeleton is supporting all of my organs and muscles. And so one of the nice things about bone is that it doesn't compress. That's one of the most important things about bone. It doesn't compress. And it, so because it doesn't compress, it can bear great weight. Right? Cartilage, on the other hand, is firm but a little flexible. And we looked at some of these, like nose, ear, rib cage. And also during development, before we have bones in our body, some bones, right, are modeled with cartilage, right? So we have cartilage where our bones are eventually going to be, and as we grow, the cartilage turns into bone. We call that process ossification. Ossification is the production of bone material. All right, so besides support, holding our body up, resisting compression, it's also important for protection. Right, so the skull is your armor plating that protects your brain. Your brain is very delicate tissue. It doesn't have any bones in there. It doesn't have any muscles holding it together. Right, your rib cage, right, protects. Here's a rib cage. It protects all of these organs in the thoracic cavity. What is, can you think of an important organ that's in the thoracic cavity that you don't want traumatized or punctured? Your heart, yeah, that's the first one that comes to mind, but also your lungs, that's important. And all those blood vessels in there, right? Those are just as important as your heart, all right? So the rib cage protects all of those organs. And the vertebral column, I see vertebral column here. Again, that's some armor plating that protects not the brain, but another part of the central nervous system that we call the spinal cord, right? So remember that dorsal body cavity has got these two cavities, the cranium that holds the brain, the vertebral cavity that holds the spinal cord, and if we put spinal cord and brain together, we like to think of that as your central nervous system. And you can see why, because it's right centrally located in your body. Okay, so that's protection. Movement. Muscles attached to bones, and a bone-to-muscle connection. What do we call a bone-to-muscle connection? That's a tendon, right? And so when a muscle contracts, pulls on the tendon pulls on the bone, and that moves the bone around. And so that's important. At the tips of bones, like I see right here in the shoulder, this is the humerus in the shoulder, and another couple bones above the shoulder, like the scapula, right, that's what we call a joint and articulation. So these bones can move with respect to each other at this particular joint. Right, so the skeleton produces joints that provides for movement. And a ligament, right, is kind of the opposite. It's not that it promotes movement like a muscle and tendons and things like that in a joint, but a ligament restricts motion. So there's some parts of our body we don't want to move. They have to be held together and limit motion in order for other joints to work properly. All right, so you have one concept and then the opposite of that concept coming together for movement. Bones are also an important reservoir, storage area, for calcium. And I think we all knew that, but maybe you haven't seen what the chemical symbol for calcium is, and that is capital C, little a. That's what we would find in chemistry books. And then you see a little positive sign right here. Probably not so important in this class, but that little positive sign means that it has an electrical charge. And it's got two positive electrical charges. And so sometimes we would call this thing an electrolyte. An electrolyte. Okay, because it has that little positive charge. And that helps maintain the proper electrical activity in our body. So we are very electrical beings. You'll really appreciate that when you get into a physiology class. All right, so storage for calcium. It's also storage for phosphate. That's another element. That phosphate is incorporated with some oxygens. That's what I see over here. So P stands for phosphate, O for oxygen. And so this whole compound right here is what we call inorganic phosphate. We have inorganic phosphate inside of our body. It helps make up the matrix of bone. But it's also very important because it helps make up everybody's favorite molecule. What's your favorite molecule that keeps you alive? ATP, right? And that P stands for basically inorganic phosphate. And ATP would have how many of these? PO4 with that 3 minus right there, how many of ATP would have? So ATP, remember, stands for adenosine triphosphate. So ATP actually has 3 of these compounds, 3 of these moieties put together to make an ATP. Okay, and there's holes inside of bones. And spaces are never wasted inside your body. If there's not a muscle there or an organ, then it's used to store fat. And there are a lot of spaces in bones, and those spaces are used to store fat. The material, mostly inside of bones, we would like to consider that marrow, bone marrow. One of the kinds of marrow is yellow, which means that it's storing fat. Another kind of marrow inside bones is what we call red bone marrow. That's responsible for making red blood cells. Right? So these cavities inside bones, we call them cavities. They can be a couple different kinds, like red and yellow, making red blood cells. Okay, what does a red blood cell do? And is it important for you? Very important, because what does it do? It carries oxygen in your blood, right? Your blood wouldn't be able to deliver much oxygen to your tissues. And there's an organelle inside your cells that desperately need that oxygen. Can you remember what organelle that is? It is the mitochondria. Mitochondria need that oxygen to make ATP, right? And it needs some other kind of nutrients, maybe like glucose, for instance, some energy source to make ATP. Okay, and so bone marrow can be yellow, storing fat, or it could be red, right? And that is producing red blood cells. That's a real important function of bone. As a matter of fact, that's the only place where red blood cells are produced is inside bones. And that process of producing red blood cells is what we call hemopoiesis. Hemo standing for red blood cells. And that takes place in cavities and bones. It produces red blood cells and platelets. What's another name for a red blood cell? Red blood cell starts with an E.
Erythrocyte.
Yeah, like erythrocyte is a red blood cell. An immune cell, which is a white blood cell, sometimes it's called a leukocyte. And then a platelet is something that stops blood loss when you damage a blood vessel. Those are called thrombocytes. All right, so what is a hemopoietic tissue? What's a hemopoietic tissue? Maybe go back to understand, what is hemopoiesis? Hemopoiesis is making red blood cells. So a hemopoietic tissue is a tissue that can do what? Make red blood cells, right? Like certain kinds of bones. A lot of bones make red blood cells when we're just an infant. We don't have many bones that make blood anymore. Most of the bones that used to make red blood cells have been converted into yellow bone marrow, but we still have a number of places, like in our hips, right, in our sternum, and maybe a couple other places, but that's about it. Okay, cartilage. Remember how many types of cartilage there are? Remember, three types. The weakest type is called hyaline. The strongest is fibrocartilage because it has collagen. And then there's one that's in between, and that's elastic cartilage. And elastic cartilage is less strong compared to fibrocartilage, but it has a characteristic that's very useful, and that is it's bendable. You can stretch it, and it goes back to its original shape. So that's pretty important. Let's talk about some types of bones. Right, depending on their shape, we can call them a long bone, a short bone. So a long bone is long. A short bone is short. But what do we mean by a long bone? So a bone has three dimensions, right? We got right, left, we got superior, inferior, and then we got anterior, posterior. So a long bone is kind of short in two dimensions. For instance, this femur right here has small dimensions when you go from left to right, and anterior to posterior, but what about superior to inferior? A lot different compared to the other two, right? So any long bone where one dimension is a lot larger than the other two, then we call that a long bone. So here are some bones in the fingertip. Ooh, let's zoom way in. I see some bones here in the fingers. These are digits, and okay, they're extremely small in dimensions from right to left, anterior to posterior, but superior to inferior, it's a large number compared to the other two. So even though these bones are really short, they're still considered long bones, right? Because only one dimension is large compared to the other two. Okay, so a long bone doesn't have to be big. Even a small one can be long. A short bone. These are different kinds of cartilage here. We'll just look at some. Long bone. Another good long bone would be the one in your arm. That's a humerus. Well, I looked at the femur. An irregular shaped bone. Here is a vertebrae, and you look at it, this is all one bone. And it's got pieces sticking out all over the place. There's a little notch. There's a big thick area. There's a really thin area here. So we call this an irregular shape. It's not long, and it's not short. Take a look at the next one here. A flat bone. Here is your breastbone, otherwise known as the sternum, and from right to left, the diameter is pretty large. From superior to inferior, it's pretty large, but if you look from anterior to posterior, it's a very small number. So this is a flat bone. Okay. And here is a short bone. This is a bone that's in your ankle. So no matter how you look at this bone, right, no matter how you look at it from right to left, superior to inferior, anterior to posterior, it has the same length. And so we call that a short bone. There's no one dimension that's really long. And this last one, I don't have a picture of, but I'll go back. Hold on. Oh, that was good. Right here. Okay, is a sesamoid bone. A sesamoid bone is a kind of bone that you find within a tendon or a ligament. Remember, a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. A ligament is a bone-to-bone connection. So here is a bone that's embedded within that kind of connective tissue. And there's a couple in your body, not very many of them, but there's one that's very prominent, and that is your kneecap. Here it is. It looks on this particular illustration as if it's just floating in front of your knee, but it's actually held there very nicely with tendons and ligaments, and it's completely enclosed within a ligament and a tendon. So that's a sesamoid bone. One thing, I don't have this on the list, okay, but one thing maybe you noticed in lab last time was something called a wormian bone or a sutural bone. These are really small bones within the sutures of the cranium, and they're just completely within a suture. They're really small, maybe even smaller than the tip of your little finger. And they're highly variable. Some of us don't have any. Some of us might have one or two, and they're just located in variable positions. So usually we don't even mention them so much, but that's another kind of bone. Okay, parts of a long bone. When we think of bone, we want to use a long bone like this one right here, the humerus, as a model to think about bone. All right, so let's look at that humerus once again. And here I see it kind of cut open a little bit. So the ends of a long bone, here is the proximal end, here's the distal end, is what we call an epiphysis. Epiphysis are the ends of a bone, and of course there's two. Right, because we're going to be looking at a long bone. And the part of the bone that's between the epiphyses are what we call the diaphysis. Another name for diaphysis is shaft. Shaft or diaphysis is exactly the same kind of thing. Surrounding the bone, there's a membrane that surrounds the bone, and I can see it peeling away. Oh, I can see it peeling away over here as well. Right, so we zoom into this region. And this is, mentioned this last time, it's an ostium because it's around a bone. And remember, we looked at periosteum and endosteum. Is this a periosteum or an endosteum? Peri means surrounding on the outside. So indeed, here is the periosteum. And it's attached to the bone itself by these perforating fibers. Sometimes we call these Sharpie's fibers, right? So it's connected to bone pretty securely. There's a membrane on the inside, right? Here I see some cavities on the inside of this long bone. I see some really small cavities up over here that make this bone look like a sponge, and then I see one big cavity in the diaphysis, right? So we call this the medullary cavity. Lining this cavity, there's another membrane, but we can't call that the periosteum. We want to call that the endosteum, right? So you got endosteum and periosteum. Here's that medullary cavity. And I can see bone marrow inside the medullary cavity. All right, and what can you tell me about this bone marrow? Is it producing red blood cells? It is not, because it would have to be red bone marrow. In this particular case, it is what? Just adipose connective tissue. Here's just a storage area for fat. Okay. Okay, now why do we call this cavity deep inside a bone the medullary cavity? Right, because the bone is an organ. It's a living organ. It has living cells, and you should be able to tell me the name of those living cells. Those cells are called, can't be chondrocytes, because chondrocyte is cartilage. They are osteocytes, right? So these bones, every 5 years, You have new bones in your body, completely remodeled, because those living cells are rebuilding your bones depending on how you use them, right? If you use them a lot and for exercise, then they get built back stronger. If you don't exercise, when they get built back, they get smaller and weaker, right? So that's why, to prevent osteoporosis, what is one of the things everybody recommends? Don't throw anything at me. This is one of the reasons why people just absolutely hate this class. So to prevent, help prevent you from getting osteoporosis, what should you do? And that is exercise, right? Oh, good. Nobody threw anything at me. Exercise is so important to keep your bones strong. And in women, especially premenopausally, that's especially important for women. Okay, so we call this the medullary cavity because any part of a living organ is, okay, the deep part. The deep part is the medulla of an organ. The superficial, right, or right on the surface, is what we call the cortex. And this is going to be true for a lot of organs we look at. The adrenal gland has a deep part and a superficial part. The superficial part of the adrenal gland is called the adrenal cortex. The deep part is called the adrenal medulla. And they're really a lot different from each other, so it's a really nice description. Same thing for bone. The medulla is the deep part. Superficial part is called the cortex. And let's go look over here. All right, so I can see some very solid bone. This very solid bone that's in the cortex is sometimes what we call compact bone, right? And because it's in the cortex, right, it's not deep inside the bone, sometimes we call that cortical bone. So cortical bone and compact bone are exactly the same kind of thing. It's just very solid bone. While the bone that's deep inside, that I see right here, that's medullary bone, right? It's not cortical, and it looks like a sponge. So sometimes we call that spongy bone. Spongy bone is medullary bone, and you can see it looks a lot different. So here is spongy bone, or medullary bone. It has a bunch of plates going all over the place, and it has a bunch of little cavities or spaces. And again, these spaces can be filled up with adipocytes. Okay. What else do I want to show you here? Oh, yes. Here's something else. All right, so here's the proximal epiphysis. Here's the distal epiphysis. The epiphyses, right, the tips of the epiphyses are covered with hyaline cartilage because these tips help make joints. All right, so this proximal epiphysis is covered with hyaline cartilage or articular cartilage because it's going to help make up the shoulder. This down over here, this articular cartilage is going to help make up the elbow joint. Okay, so that's why that cartilage is there. And if I look at this medullary bone, which is spongy bone, can you see this line going right through the bone? Okay, in the epiphysis. There's one, or maybe even two in the proximal epiphysis. There is one in the distal epiphysis, which you can't see because the bone is not cut open. This is what we call the epiphyseal line, if we cut the bone open. But you should think of it as a plate, right? So it's really like a plate, a teacup saucer right here. And this is the area during development that the bone grows in length, right? This epiphyseal plate is the area that a bone grows in length from the proximal epiphysis, right? And then inferiorly from the distal epiphysis. And during development, as the bone is growing, it is not bone. It is cartilage in this area. So what kind of tissue do you think is stronger, bone or cartilage? Bone is a lot stronger, right? So during development, before puberty, people have this cartilage plate in long bones, and it's easily damaged as a result, right? Because cartilage is not very strong. And so if, for some reason, a youngster twists a bone, that can damage this plate, or if it's compressed, like if they jump off of a swing, it was really fun, right? You ever been on a swing and you start swinging back and forth and you get really, really high and then you let go of the swing and you go flying through the air? Is that really wonderful? It's wonderful, except for the end, right? Because you have to crash into something, right? So if you crash into something, you put a lot of axial compression on this growth plate, which is cartilage in young people, and it can damage the growth plate. And if you damage one leg but not the other, then one leg won't grow as fast, compared to the other one, and it will be shorter as a result of that. Okay, so unfortunately that can happen. So this is sometimes called the growth plate. All right, Sharpie's fibers, cortical bone. Okay, we're going to look at another way to think of compact bone or cortical bone. Oh, here is something. We're looking at the epiphysis of a bone, right? So here's some hyaline cartilage. And we're looking at a nice cross-section. You see these circles inside of circles, which are tubes inside tubes, right? This structure is what we're going to call an osteon. Let's go to the next picture. All right, so here is a pretty good exam figure, right? So here we have a long bone that we cut open. This right here is what we call an osteon. Sometimes we call that a haversian system because it's got a number of components. In the very center, there is a space that runs up and down the length of this tube, and it contains blood vessels, arteries, and veins, and even some nerves in the central canal. Here's the central canal of an osteon. So when you break a bone, some of these things can be broken. What happens when you break a bone? Because of all of these things inside the central canal of all of these osteons. What happens when you break a bone? And can it be dangerous? Well, it hurts really bad, but can it be dangerous? Yeah, because all these blood vessels will break, right? And when a blood vessel breaks, then it will hemorrhage. And if it's a big bone, like a femur, somebody can actually bleed to death when they break a femur, right? And that's so common in the United States because we can usually get to a hospital pretty fast. But some parts of the world, that's a fatal kind of accident because you remember, bones are living tissue. They need blood to remain alive, and this is how they get blood. Okay, so these layers, these tubes inside tubes, right, these are what we call lamellae. And so I see tubes inside tubes that make up an osteon, and then there's even tubes that surround all of the osteons on the outside of the bone. These lamellae on the outside are what we call circumferential lamellae, right, because they surround the whole diameter of the bone. And the ones that make up a osteon we call concentric lamellae. So there's two kinds of lamellae, concentric that make up the osteon, circumferential that make up the bone. And this is a pretty interesting slide because here is an osteon, and right, we've pulled out some of these different concentric lamellae. So I see the innermost one, one in the middle, there's one on the outside. So indeed, they are what, tubes inside tubes. So the nature of bone, compact bone, because it's made up of all these tubes, it doesn't compress. Not only is calcium phosphate non-compressible, but these tubes also prevent compression. So that's the importance. And oh, look at this. Here you can see nerves and blood vessels in that central canal. Here is a communication from one haversian system to the other. And we're going to call these perforating canals or Volkmann's canals as opposed to haversian canals, which are in the center of the osteon. Right, so this is a pretty typical view of a bone, right? Compact bone. And what kind of tissue is bone? What kind of tissue is bone? Okay, how many kinds of tissues are there in your body? Just four. And this one is? Connective tissue, right? Connective tissue. All right, so cortical bone, sometimes it's called compact bone. Medullary bone has got a number of different names. We said spongy bone, cancellous bone, trabecular bone. It just means that it's made up of all of these different plates right here. All right, so that is medullary bone. Chemical composition of bones. Right, have a couple different kinds of chemicals in there. And it's really important to know these different kinds of chemicals that make bone up. Okay, and all the chemicals that make bone up can be broken down into two categories. Organic components. Organic components are something that a cell has to make, has to generate and put together. And then there are inorganic components. These inorganic components you cannot make. You have to have these things in your diet. Okay, so the organic components are cells. And you should know the name of one kind of cell already in bone. That is an osteocyte. That might be important on the practicum too. All right, so an osteocyte maintains mature bone. And they're always found in lacunae. When a bone is built, they're built with a cell that's called an osteoblast. So when you hear that term osteoblast, you have a sense that it's a cell that you find in bone. Is that a bone cell? How would you know? Osteoblast because, yeah, somebody told me. Because of this osteo, right? Osteo just means bone. An osteoblast is a bone builder, blast builder. Okay, and an osteoclast, on the other hand, is a cell, a bone cell, right? Because there's osteo that breaks bone down. So this dissolves bone. And that's pretty important because remember, what's on, deep inside the bone, there's a big cavity. So as bone grows, it's solid, and then these osteoclasts have to carve out that little cavity, that medullary cavity. So in order to have healthy bones, there has to be a balance between the cells that build bone and the cells that break bone down. All right, so these two cells work against each other, but that's a really important concept in class, which I'll elaborate on a little bit later, okay, in the class. There's also some progenitor cells, right? And these progenitor cells can become regular osteocytes, right? And they're found both in the periosteum and endosteum. All right, so these are cells. Remember, bone is a living tissue because of these cells. Another organic compound is a fiber that's secreted by these osteocytes. And that fiber is collagen. And what can you tell me about collagen? What do you know about collagen? It's strong, right? So that's a good thing to have in bone. Right? That collagen, and that's what I see on this slide over here. I see the concentric lamellae, and then I see the fibers, the collagen fibers. Right? So in one lamellae, they're twisting in one direction. The next deepest lamella, they're twisting in the other direction. And then the deepest lamella, you can see them twisting in even a third direction. So all of these fibers are really important because it prevents the stretching of bone. It holds bone together that way. Collagen fibers prevent the stretching. We call that tension. Right? So collagen gives the bone some flexibility, but it resists stretching, which is tension, and it also resists twisting. Right, so a bone doesn't twist, and it doesn't pull apart when you pull on it. And because of some of the inorganic components right here, it doesn't compress when you push on the ends. So those are the three kinds of forces that you can apply to something. You can try to stretch it out, that's tension. You can try to push it together, that's compression, or you can try to twist it, and that's what we call torsion. And bones can resist all of those things, right? So stretching, so tension and torsion are resisted by the collagen that I see on this figure, okay? All of these inorganic components, right, like calcium, inorganic phosphate, these are put together to make calcium phosphate, and then these things are even put together to make hydroxyapatite. Hydroxyapatite is just calcium and phosphate put together. This is the compound that assures that bone cannot compress, that when you try to force the ends of a bone together, right, those ends of the bone do not come any closer together. So inorganic components, right, prevent compression. And because compression cannot happen, then we say bones are really important for support. They can support your body weight. Okay. So, what components of a bone resist torsion? Good question. Torsion is twisting. What component of a bone resists twisting? It's the organic, in particular, the collagen fibers, right? What component of a bone resists compression when you try to squeeze a bone down? What component? It is the inorganic component called hydroxyapatite, or you could say calcium, right? And what component resists tension, pulling apart? Again, that's collagen once again, the fiber, right? And you could even kind of think of these things, like I see a column right here that's holding up the building. Here's a nice column over here made of cement. That cement, in my mind, kind of acts like calcium and phosphate, the hydroxyapatite. So concrete can hold a lot of weight. But one thing concrete can't do is that when you start to pull it, it just crumbles apart. So it cannot resist tension. And if that column started to twist, it would crumble apart as well. It can't resist torsion, right? Concrete is only good for compression. So how do we make concrete like that stronger so that it can resist tension and twisting? So, because we don't want that thing crumbling. It's great if the building is just sitting here. All the building can sit on it. Concrete is happy. But what happens if it starts to twist or pull apart? It's going to crumble. So what's inside? Anybody know what's inside that concrete column right there so that when it twists a little bit or when it gets pulled apart, it just doesn't completely crumble? There's something kind of similar to collagen, and there are metal fibers in there called rebar, right? Maybe you've seen people making things out of concrete, and there's metal cables and rods inside the concrete, and that's what provides that support, prevents it from stretching and from twisting, because concrete will just crumble, right, if it's stretched. So those rebar are what I like to think of that models in my mind these collagen fibers right here. Okay, we need to look at some microscopic detail. Here is some nice microscopic detail. So we're looking at just a cross-section of an osteon, but only like one quarter of it, right? Because these concentric lamellae go all the way around. Here I can see the artery, the vein, and the nerve within the central canal of this osteon. I can see the end ostium, right? And here is a cell. What kind of cell is this thing? What is this cell? It's in bone. It's an osteocyte, yeah. And I can see the nucleus right there. This little bubble that the osteocyte is in within the matrix of the bone, that's what we call a lacunae, right? So here's an osteocyte inside a lacunae. And the matrix of bone is really solid, right? Like this tabletop right here. Things like oxygen and water can't move through this tabletop. These cells need nutrients and oxygen and water. So how do they get there from these blood vessels? These nutrients move through these little canals between the lacunae, and they're called canaliculi, right? And so they're filled with a water-like material or parts of a cell, so this cell over here can share oxygen with this one over here, and this one over here can share oxygen and nutrients with this osteocyte way out over here. All right, so these things really are not fractures. They really belong there. They are passageways for nutrients to get from your blood to all of these living osteocytes. All right, so we got concentric lamellae, central canal, nerve, artery, vein, canaliculi, osteocyte, and lacuna. Right, a lacuna is one. Lacunae are what? That's plural. So that's a nice example of, okay, that osteon. So circumferential lamellae surround the whole bone. Right, concentric lamellae, these right here, make up an osteon. They're smaller layers. The diameter is much smaller. A little bit of a difference between concentric and circumferential lamellae. All right, so here's a pretty good question. What is the structural and functional unit of compact bone? Compact bone, cortical bone, is the same thing. Does anybody, when we think of the structural and functional unit of something, right? If you know how this one item is put together and how it functions, you know how all bone functions. And I see one of them right here. Who can tell me what this structure is? That's an osteon. That's right. So the structural and functional unit of compact bone is called an osteon. So make sure you know all the pieces that make up an osteon, right? The concentric lamellae, the collagen fibers, the osteocytes, the canaliculi, the lacunae. And if you got all those pieces, put them together, you know how this whole bone right here is put together, because it just is a pattern that repeats itself over and over and over again. Let's talk a little bit about bone formation and growth. All right, there are two kinds, intramembranous ossification, and ossification just means turning something into bone, making bone. right? Because osteo is bone, ossification is making bone. Here is a kind of making bone from membranes in your body. We call that intramembranous. So this kind of bone making happens within inside a membrane. Some bones, before they're bones in your body, are just membranes. And that is something like most flat bones in the body were membranes at one time that got filled in with calcium by those osteoblasts to become a flat bone. Another kind of ossification is endochondrial ossification. So before the bone was there, okay, in endochondrial ossification, it was not a membrane. It was something else. Who could tell me what that something else is? Cartilage. Yeah, because anytime you hear chondrochondrial, right, that means cartilage. So a lot of the bones in your body, actually most of them, looked like a bone, except they were made out of cartilage first, right? And then that cartilage model was ossified, was filled in. All right, so let's talk about some of the processes that make these things. Osteoblasts, what, make bone. All right, so osteoblast in this membrane right here, laying a bone matrix down within the membrane. All right, osteoblasts become osteocytes after the bone is formed, because that's a nice mature bone cell. At birth, these flat bones, or the bones from intramembranous ossification, are not completely formed. The bones of your skull are flat. And when you're born, a large part of those bones are still membranes. So why is that good for a newborn baby or one that's about to be born? We call that a neonate. Why is it a good idea to have membranes where bones are going to be in your skull instead of having a completely formed skull already? Does everybody ever have a baby in here? Because, right, that infant has to move through the birth canal, right, which is cervix and vagina, and cervix and vagina are not big enough for an infant's head to squeeze through. So the infant's head actually has to squish down, it changes shape a little bit, and then after birth, okay, the head kind of goes back to the position that it should be in. It might take a little while, okay? So that's important for parturition. Another thing is that the head, right, the neonate head, skull, grows very, very rapidly. The brain grows very, very rapidly, and if that undeveloped brain was surrounded by a hard bone, it couldn't grow as fast as it would need to grow. And so those membranes allow the head to stretch to accommodate the rapid growth of an infant's brain. I don't know if you've ever looked at an infant and surprised how big their head was compared to the rest of their body. And that's because the brain is growing so rapidly compared to other parts of the body. And then the other parts of the body catch up to where you don't look like you have such a big head anymore. Okay. All right, so remember, when you're born, some of those bones in the head are still membranes. And so what's stronger, a membrane or bone? What's going to be stronger, a membrane or bone? Yeah, bone is a lot stronger. So these membranes, right, that are in the fetal skull, I don't think I have a picture. I'll show you a picture in the next chapter. Okay, those membranes in the fetal skull are what we call fontanelles. And in lab, you're going to have to know a couple fontanelles. And otherwise, they're called soft spots because they're not as strong as bone. And so a baby's head can be damaged very easily because it's not completely made up of bone. They're still membranes. So these soft spots or fontanelles are susceptible to puncture wounds, right? So you always got to protect the baby's head very carefully. But also what? Twisting, okay, or compression. Either of these kinds of motions can damage a baby's brain as a result of that. So even though you don't punch a hole in a baby's head, but if you have a newborn baby and you throw it up in the air and you catch them and they're twisting a little bit or shaking an infant, that is still really bad because it's what? It's producing tension and twisting on the skull, and that's still really bad. And here's something that shocked me when I learned this statistic. Fontanelles can last for up to 2 years in a newborn baby. I thought they would kind of go away kind of fast, but 2 years, because that's how fast the brain is growing in a newborn baby, right? So got to be really careful with the skull of a newborn for 2 years. There's a kind of dog, this is really quick, there's a kind of dog that has fontanelles their whole life. Anybody know what kind of dog that is? Has fontanelles their whole life? It's a chihuahua. Okay, has fontanelles. So their head is kind of susceptible to puncture wounds and everything. I always thought it'd be really fun to have a really big dog, like a Great Dane or Rottweiler or a Doberman Pinscher, and then have a really small dog like a Chihuahua, you know, because they're just so different looking. But then I thought, gee whiz, you know, if they start playing around a little bit, that big dog, just by playing around, could really hurt that little Chihuahua because the Chihuahua doesn't have a completely formed skull, right? So any kind of just activity could be really bad for that Chihuahua. Okay, endochondrial ossification was the other kind. Right, and so what's the precursor to bones when they're made from endochondrial ossification? They are not membranes, they are cartilage, right? They're just, they look like a bone, but they're out of cartilage. So endochondrial ossification, like for long bones, and that cartilage is a hyaline cartilage, and then the cartilage, right, starts to ossify. And here's a couple processes where that happens, primary and secondary, and then here's that epiphyseal plate. So let's see what I can find. All right, look at the slide over here. So here is a model of a long bone, and it's made out of cartilage. All right, so what kind of ossification is taking place here? This cartilage is going to become a bone. This is either intramembranous or endochondrial. Because it's cartilage, it is endochondrial ossification. So I see two areas. I see one deep inside the bone, and I see on the edge, the superficial edge. These are the primary ossification centers. Right? So sometimes this is actually a ring around the bone. We call this a bone collar. And then we have some ossification taking place deep inside the bone. As the bone grows, right, this area here, there are osteoclasts that dissolve the bone away to help make the medullary cavity, but these osteoblasts over here are still building a lot of bone. And the bone just gets a little bit bigger, and then some secondary ossification centers develop in the tips of these bones. What do we call the tip of a bone? It's a funny word, it's got a little swing to it. It is called the epiphyses, yeah, proximal epiphysis, right, distal epiphysis. So the epiphyses start to ossify. These are the secondary ossification centers, right? So the primary and secondary kind of grow together, but as somebody is still growing before puberty, it always leaves this little area of cartilage, right, which has osteoblasts. So bone grows in length, right, from this epiphyseal plate and the proximal end and both the distal end of this bone. All right, so bone grows in length from the epiphyseal plates, but bone also grows in diameter from osteoblasts that are in the periosteum. Periosteum has osteoblasts. So bone grows in two different ways. And sometimes we call this appositional growth, where there is one part of the bone that's making bone, like the periosteum, and another part that is dissolving bone away. Right, and those osteoclasts are in the endosteum. So the endosteum, periosteum kind of work together, but against each other to make a bone grow in the proper way, and we call that oppositional growth. Okay, bone remodeling. Remember, I said every 5 years you get new bones. So there are cells that are breaking your bones down all the time. Can you remember what kind of cell breaks down bone? The osteoclasts, right? They break bone down, and then there are cells that build bone up to make that bone appropriate for your particular body, right? So if you exercise a lot, they get built back stronger. And those would be the osteoblasts. So this is a process that takes place, remodeling, for instance, if you break a bone, right? When you break a bone, you have a bunch of little bone fragments that are kind of sharp, they could lacerate blood vessels and nerves. Those osteoclasts break down all of those bone fragments, and then a little bit later the osteoblasts move in and begin to deposit new bone matrix. So remodeling of a bone, once it's broken, takes 4 to 6 weeks. And that's a pretty fast period of time. So bones can repair themselves very rapidly, okay? And I can see the reason why here. Why can a bone repair itself rapidly in a matter of just a few weeks, while cartilage can't? Okay? Some other kind of connective tissues can't? Why can bone regenerate itself very nicely, pretty rapidly? Because it has these nice blood vessels going in there, bringing in oxygen and nutrients and calcium and phosphate, right? So bone is highly vascular. The downside of it being highly vascular, when it's broken, it can hemorrhage and you can bleed to death. But the trade-off there, the good thing is that once it's broken and you don't bleed to death, bone can heal itself very nicely, very rapidly, because of that nice blood supply, right? As long as you don't break that bone again in the process of healing. All right, so there's something called a callus. When bone is broken, it's just a fibroblasts move in and they lay down a lot of collagen, a lot of fibers between all the broken bone pieces. And what kind of fiber is collagen again in terms of strength? Yeah, really strong, right? So this callus kind of holds that broken bone together, not as strong as bone, but it's still trying to hold the bones together. And then that callus, right, gets filled in with calcium and phosphate. We call that ossification, right? So the osteoblasts, that's the kind of cell that builds bone, move in and deposit a new bone matrix. And like I said, it takes 4 to 6 weeks, as long as you don't break the bone in that healing process, because that callus is not very strong. And after this process takes place, then that fracture can actually be a stronger location in the bone than that bone before it was broken, because it has more collagen, right? And it has a little bit more bone matrix as well. So broken bones can even be stronger than the bone before it was broken. Okay, so remember, how many different kinds of bone growth are there? There's two. And who knows the name of one of them? Anybody know the name of one of those types of bone growth? Intramembranous, that's right. Most of the bones in the skull were made by intramembranous ossification, flat bones. And the other kind is endochondrial, because remember, chondral refers to cartilage, right, cartilage. And here is a nice cartilage model of a long bone. This could be like one in your fingers, like a phalanges, or it could be your femur in your thigh, or your humerus that's in your arm, right? All by endochondrial ossification. Okay, so that's it for the material for the test. So look at these exam figures for this chapter. I don't think there's many of them, but probably that osteon is one, right? Because that's a structural and functional unit of compact bone. And how you think of a long bone, how do you think of a long bone? Here's a typical long bone. The ends are the epiphyses, the shaft is the diaphysis, you got the medullary cavity, periosteum on the outside, endosteum on the inside. Medullary cavity in this particular case has adipose tissue, so it's yellow bone marrow. Compact bone is superficial, so sometimes we call that cortical bone. Medullary bone is deep and it looks like a sponge, so we call that spongy bone. And when this bone is growing in length, where does it grow in length from? I see it on this slide. From the epiphyseal plates, because when the bone is growing, they're cartilage, right? And then after puberty, then, okay, oh, I didn't mention this. At puberty, that cartilage is ossified. It just turns into bone. So at puberty, these bones don't grow in length anymore. And so who reaches puberty first? Males or females? Typically females, right? And at puberty, this epiphyseal plate ossifies, becomes an epiphyseal line. And so that's one way to understand why, within at least a family, females are typically a little bit shorter compared to males, because they reach puberty sooner, and that closes off this epiphyseal plate, right? While males still grow for a little while longer, a year or two, and so their bones still grow for that period of time. So typically they're a little bit taller, right? That doesn't mean that if we look, every woman is short, every male is tall, but kind of holds true within a family, right? And then maybe not exactly true as well. Depends on your mom and dad and grandpa and grandma and all that kind of stuff, okay? Okay, anybody have a question on this particular chapter? All right, so I think we're doing pretty good. So next time, a picture ID, a pencil, a really fantastic eraser, and an 882E or an 882ES Scantron. So I'll see you up in lab. Today, there is not a quiz. But tomorrow, there is going to be a quiz, like the skull labeling, and I'll show you exactly in lab when we get to lab what could be on the quiz for next time.